Interview with Don Kirk, March 31st, 2011, in Greenwich, Connecticut, by Kenneth Durr. Great. Well, let's hit a little bit of the background. And I know you went to Yale. I want to find out if you had a pre-existing interest in accounting at that point in undergrad.
Well, I did by the time I went back to Yale. My Yale time was split by 4 years of military service. But when I first went to Yale in 1951, I really had no idea what I was getting into at the university. Sort of thought, well, I was going to go into business, and maybe that meant economics was a subject that was I should take. I quickly discovered in the basic economic course that it really wasn't necessarily what I was looking for. So I was sort of adrift in my 2 years initially. I couldn't decide what to major in came the second year. I figured it was time to maybe do something different. That time, your only option was go into the military. So I dropped out after sophomore year.
Okay.
Went into a naval aviation cadet program, which required 2 years of college, which I had. So I went through flight training and became a carrier-based jet pilot and served 4 years. And during that time, I got married. I started to search for what it was I should do when I get out. The Navy tried to keep me in, but I had the GI Bill and said, no, I think I'll get out. And I had always intended to go back to Yale. I did, much more motivated student, no clear-cut career path in mind, except I had taken a correspondence course when I was in the Navy in accounting. It was from the University of Maryland. It sort of intrigued me. The only reason I even did it was my father was a certified public accountant. I never had any involvement with it or experience with it at all, but it seemed to be something to try. So I did that correspondence course, and when I went back to Yale in 1957, I decided I was going to be a major in history, and discovered that there were a couple of accounting courses in the economics department. So I fit those into my my schedule, and even went to a local college at night to take a course in taxation. And so by the time I graduated, I only interviewed public accounting firms. So,
did you have a history degree, or did you?
I had a history degree, okay. Yes, right, huh. I did. So I had an awful lot of business-type credits I had to take to qualify to become a CPA.
So you put your resume out to all the Big Eight firms, I guess it was at this point?
Well, there were several that actually came to interview at Yale. Two that I was really intrigued with were Pricewaterhouse, and another firm was Arthur Young, since merged with Ernst & Ernst. They really set a couple of attractive recruiters. One, Bryce Waterhouse, was a Yale graduate, and I was intrigued, but I didn't want to go to full-time business school. Arthur Young offered to put me on the payroll and send me to school in Chicago, I think University of Chicago, for an MBA, Pricewaterhouse said, well, there are plenty of schools in New York, and we'll keep you in New York City, and you can do probably an MBA at night, which is what I did do.
Was that considered something that was pretty much you needed to do, was get the MBA?
Needed it, because at that time there were academic requirements to take the CPA exam.
Okay.
I didn't have the course needs.
So you wanted to get into a firm and then work, deal with the MBA.
Yes, that's where I decided I really wanted to go to work full-time and fit in the MBA. And Pricewaterhouse sort of made it easy to keep me in New York City. And so I started in the evening program right away. I went straight through beginning in the summer of 59. Was able to schedule it, so it was only two nights a week.
During this at Columbia?
At New York University, okay. NYU, okay. Which had its business school downtown Manhattan, which is where the Pricewaterhouse office was in downtown Manhattan. And I chose to live on Staten Island, so which it took a ferry ride back and forth. And so there was sort of great convenience, or lack of inconvenience, to the work schedule, commuting. And so I got it, the MBA done in June of 61.
So yeah. I imagine you probably got into auditing first off.
Yes, I definitely went on the audit staff of Pricewaterhouse.
Did that experience turn out the way you thought it might?
Well, even though I had taken these two courses at Yale, and I had worked part-time for a CPA who actually was a professor of mine while at Yale, but I didn't have the slightest idea what auditing was all about. What I'd been introduced to were what were known as accounting principles, and but literally nothing about auditing, what an auditing firm did. And so right away, I said, oh my gosh, what... but they had a 1 month training program. I did that in the summer of 61. Summer of 59. Summer of 59, that's when I finally graduated. And that, together with sort of the night school courses I were taking, sort of gave me a pretty good rapid introduction into what it was I was hired to do. And... So by the fall, I was out on a team. So
you moved into some pretty big audits early on. Paramount Pictures was one of
them? Well, I was the youngster on Paramount Pictures. The instructor in the summer course I took at Pricewaterhouse, he nabbed me. He was the senior the manager on that assignment, and so he picked me to go on that audit team. And it was an incredibly good experience, both because of the nature of the business was sort of fascinating. The accounting problems were very intriguing. You were dealing with an intangible asset of indeterminate value in life, and great many sort of judgmental issues about... what do you include in the cost of it? When do you recognize a loss on it? How does its value expire? And so there were just loads of interesting kind of theoretical questions.
And you would have had to be a movie buff, too, to figure out what the values were and when they'd expire.
Yeah. It was a crapshoot. I think they used to think maybe 1 out of 10 was a kind of a moneymaker. So it involved many interesting people in the management of the business, as well as very intriguing kinds of accounting and reporting issues. So it was really a great, great training ground for me.
Did you end up, as you moved along and built up your experience, did you end up getting slotted in with a regular client? In the 60s?
I mean, that was an irregular client.
I know that was sort of an early standout. Did you stick with them all through the...
Actually, I did. I was in New York office from 59 to 67. Mm-hmm. And throughout that time... I was involved in Paramount. I became what's known as a senior accountant and a manager. And so right up until the time I became a partner in 1967, I was involved with that particular client. There were many others, but that was the one that really was the training ground for me in many, many ways.
Was that the biggest job?
It probably was the biggest. I know American Distillers. There were a number of companies, but that's the one that sort of sticks with me, just from its experience kind of viewpoint.
It didn't fit sort of in all the categories, I guess. You had to do more thinking?
Very definitely. It wasn't just mechanics. It was sort of intellectual challenge and questions, and then topped off with unusual and sometimes very difficult personnel, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Major egos in some ways. And so in that regard, it was kind of a good experience. I often said it was often trying to find an honest voice, someone who would really level with you. And I vividly remember one person there at Columbia that you could really count on for, not at Columbia, Paramount, but for a straight answer.
There were a lot of promoters and things.
There. Oh, yes. Yes.
What was the next step once you became partner?
I became a partner in 1967. I'd been with the firm 8 years. And before I became a partner, the then senior partner of the firm came to me and said, we don't do this, I've never done this before, but we'd like to make you a partner, but we'd also like you to transfer to Washington, D.C. And I don't know if he explained at the time, but there had, a short time before, there had been a partner admitted who then resigned. And it turned out it was because he didn't want to be transferred to where they said he should go. And the senior partner said, well, we don't want that to sort of happen. So here's a heads up. And I said, well, I don't know anything about it, so let me go down and visit. And so I did. And there was one overworked audit partner in the office, one tax partner, Roscoe Egger, who later became a commissioner of Internal Revenue Service. And I could see that they needed help. And it was such an entirely different kind of practice from New York City. Service companies, small companies. But I could see that they needed help, and I'd be busy. I wouldn't be carrying some senior partner's bag. So with the understanding of the senior partner, it was for 3 years, I said, okay, I'll go. And so then that year, 67, I went to Washington, D.C., and actually was there 3 years, which fellow partners told me it's very unusual that they stuck to their word. And so I spent years in that quite different environment, New York City environment. So.
Well, then was it back to New York?
Then it was back to New York. While I was in Washington, D.C., the man who was going to become the senior partner asked if I would join him on an audit assignment in London, which was the Royal Dutch Shell group of companies. Very unusual kind of audit relationship. There was a partner from the U.S. firm, a partner from a United Kingdom firm, a different firm, and a partner in a Dutch firm, who all three signed the opinion on the Royal Dutch Shell group of companies. Now, most of the actual audit work was done by PW affiliates around the world. So we took some comfort in the fact that a lot of the underlying work was done by PW people. The other two firms were a very small UK firm, and the other was a Dutch firm, which ultimately became part of KPMG. It's the K in KPMG. And it was a bit larger. It was a good-sized firm in the Netherlands. But he asked me to join him because he was destined to become the senior partner.
Now, was he the one who had to sign with these other two
firms?
Okay.
Yes, he was.
That must have been quite a transaction, sitting down and working through all that.
The three partners and some key staff sort of shared an office. It's back when people smoked, too, as well. So it was a smoke-filled room. And sometimes the Dutch and the staff would speak in their native language, and we were never quite sure what they were up to or talking about. And so it was one of these very unique corporate entities and a very unusual three-party audit assignment. And it didn't fit into anything I was doing in Washington, D.C. So it would take me away for maybe anywhere from a minimum of 4, maybe 6 weeks a year to go to London. And so I started doing that while I was still in Washington, D.C. And so when I went back to New York, I continued with that relationship. And that relationship sort of disrupted other responsibilities because it was totally outside of the New York office kind of routine, and as it was outside the routine of the Washington office. So I had to kind of fit other assignments, or they had to fit other assignments around that obligation. And the motion picture companies started to come back on the scene, and I took responsibility for Columbia Pictures and one other company. And I think then they tried to make me the fine arts expert, have the Metropolitan Opera and a few other such clients, which really wasn't my bag, but having gone to Yale, they thought I somehow must know something about these kind of activities. And so I was there from back there from 70 to really early 73. And I got approached about joining the FASB sometime late in 1972. And joined as one of the original board members.
Now, had you been watching closely as the APB kind of fell apart there, or ran into a wall, so to speak?
I was aware of several things. One, what were referred to as the go-go years of the 1960s into the 70s, of kind of the atmosphere. And at Washington, I got assigned a lot of small companies, which were frantically trying to raise money from the public and trying to keep them reasonably honest in their reporting. And so I knew that there were all kinds of accounting issues and what I would think about as questionable accounting practices. I was kind of aware of what the APB was doing, more so when I went back to New York. And I never had a technical responsibility in the firm. I never carried the bag for an APB member. But I was aware of what was going on. I had kind of a good communication, good relationship with a couple of technical partners in the firm, and would occasionally register my disagreement with maybe a firm position on what was going on the APB. And the senior partner, the one who I did the Royal Dutch Shell work and then I took it over from, was John Beekler. He succeeded Herman Beavis as the senior partner of the firm. He had been a member on the APB after Beavis stepped down. And he He then was followed by a much more technically minded member on the APB. So I was kind of aware of personnel or people who were on the APB, where they came from, a little bit about their firm philosophies, knew more about PWs than obviously any of the other firms. And so I was knowledgeable. Now, because of all the things I've gone through since, kind of looking back to what I knew then is a little difficult to construct, but I certainly knew that there were problems in the setting of accounting principles. No question about it. And something kind of needed to be done. And 1971, the pressures on the APB were very strong. They had got off to a very rocky start. They decided, or then, I think he was the president of the American Institute, said, okay, we're going to take a fresh start with the Accounting Principles Board. We've had this committee of accounting procedures in existence for 20 years, and we need a fresh start.
This is in the 60s.
Yes, this was 1959. Yeah. We're going to get a fresh start. We're going to give a little more authority to this new group, Accounting Principles Board. We're going to put the senior partners of the firms on the board. Therefore, we'll, quote, get buy-in or commitment. And we're going to do what people have failed to do for years. We're going to do some research on what is the foundation of accounting principles and what do we mean by it. And how do we decide what's sound or unsound? And so we're going to sponsor some research before we start. There's an interesting contrast to what happened in 1939. But 1959, they said, we're going to do research. And they engaged a professor from Berkeley, Morris Moonitz, who I think became research director at the American Institute. And they undertook a couple of research studies on sort of basic tenets for financial reporting. And there was the second one, Moonitz had as a co-author Robert T. Sprouse, Bob Sprouse, who became an FASB member, one of my favorite people, now deceased. But they issued these reports. Don't ask me exactly what they contained, but the APB rejected them. They said they're too radical. So we're not going to adopt these as sort of the basis for accountability as we go forward. We've got issues to deal with. And so they started to deal with issues. 1962, they took out an issue of daily accounting for the investment credit and badly divided board. It favored sort of spreading the effect of the investment credit.
The flow-through?
Versus the flow-through method. And the immediate outcry by the people who descended to it, the SEC jumped in and said, well, we think there's a substantial, quote, authoritative support for the flow-through method, too. And I think it was a year or so later, they went back to the subject in APB opinion number 4, reconfirmed that, yeah, we think it should be spread, the effect should be spread, divided opinion. But, oh, by the way, there is authoritative support for the other method, so I guess it's okay. And so from 1959 through APB opinion 4, they had spent an immense amount of time with nothing to show for it. And so the APB just got off to the wrong start. I mean, the chemistry between some of those senior partners was awful. And I know particularly between the APB, I mean, the PW senior partner and Leonard Spacek of Arthur Andersen, there just wasn't good chemistry. They were rivals, competitors. And so that didn't help. And the APB sort of kind of switched from the main honchos to the more technically sound partners in the firms.
Those honchos ended up having staff people who did a lot of the work.
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course. And they were all, you know, all part-time people. And they accomplished a great deal, but it was catch-up. I mean, they really produced a lot of sort of pronouncements, but they could kind of never catch up. And by the time they got around to business combinations, that one kind of was the nail in the coffin. They had to issue two separate opinions, and there were great division in the members. So there were lots of kind of dissents and qualified assents to the to those two statements. And everyone was kind of getting fed up. And finally, in 1971, the Institute said, uh-oh. They commissioned really two studies. One was headed up by a man, Robert Trueblood, dealing with kind of the objectives, again, of financial reporting. Okay, let's get some fundamentals in place. The second was structural, and that was headed up by Francis Wheat, partner and Gibson Dunn West Coast firm, former SEC member, to look at the structure of how standards should be set. And I think I said Marshall Armstrong was president of the Institute at that time.
Okay.
When those two studies were initiated. And the the Wheat study, that was kind of a more immediate kind of interest. You could kind of relate to that. I knew enough about the history about people trying to define the principles of accounting that I wasn't quite sure what might come of that, if anything. And so it was sometime in 72, I think, that the Wheat study came out, and it, March of 72 was when it was finally issued. And it was extraordinarily thoughtful, perceptive document. The actual, I think, writer, the main writer of the document was a man for whom I generated immense respect, named David Solomons. David was a professor from the UK originally, but David Solomons was at the Wharton School in Penn, and he had an extraordinary ability to write clearly, gifted, a very gifted man. But there were many other key people, and Frank Wheat obviously was the leader of the group. So it came out in 72. It proposed a structure which the FASB emulated in great detail. I mean, there were some definite variations and such. But
did everybody in the profession sort of sit up and take notice when the Wheat Report came out and there was a sense that things were going to change?
I think that's so. I think certainly, at least I think, and from my perspective, I just said there was a crying need for change. The APB had lost its credibility, and any time as witness other attempts that there's sort of a self-regulatory endeavor, doubt often comes in about the objectivity of those who are in charge. Its part-time nature was kind of criticized as well. But I think just the great suspicion that the accountants were setting their own kind of rules was had become kind of suspect. And all professions, you know, start out as kind of guilds and often developing rules that sometimes are thought of as being very self-protective rather than having the public interest in mind.
Did the within the profession, was there a desire for more rules or more standards? Was there a sense that APB was not serving the auditors out there in the field?
Yes, there was some of that. There always were these kind of two schools. One that if you just got some good, sound, basic principles, you wouldn't need any rules. Experience had shown that every time they tried to get some basic principles, it deteriorated and they kind of went back to making rules. And so there were different schools of thought. There were and sort of what this board would do, it was dealing only with structure, the wheat study. And it said Trueblood's dealing with sort of the principles and objectives, and this new board can take that up for consideration. So the wheat study was focused strictly structurally. And it made immense sense to me that the people to be on this board would be full-time, no understanding about any other employment. But then, of course, it boiled down to kind of the politics of what's going to be the makeup of this board. And the wheat group obviously had a variety of people on it, one of whom was Roger Smith, who maybe at the time wasn't yet the CEO, but became the CEO of General Motors. And General Motors had a long history of interest and involvement in accounting, in part because a number of their CEOs had come up on the finance side. I think Donner did, Tom Murphy certainly did, Roger Smith certainly did. And also there were some larger firms and smaller firms on that on the wheat study group itself. But the biggest elephant in the room was the American Institute of CPAs, because they were being asked to give up the setting of accounting principles. This was their reason for being, in a way. And obviously they were somewhat protective. So the makeup of the original board was influenced by that historic connection. And I believe the initial requirements were that maybe four of the seven members had to have a public accounting sort of background.
They would come from one of the big eight firms, I guess.
Well, that was kind of unsaid as to where they might come from. But they obviously, they had the APB members and people who sort of supported them. There was sort of a kind of a group that weren't all necessarily big eight, but they were, the Big Eight were the ones that could put the resources into the APB. And but there was no sort of definition of where they would come from.
So how did you end up getting tapped for one of the seats?
Well, I had mentioned my my connection with John Beagler. There was nothing personal about the relationship, strictly a professional relationship. And so, I mean, he knew who I was. He was senior partner of the firm and had been on the APB, was on the wheat study, and he was among the additional court of board of trustees of the foundation that was to oversee this new FASB. And some stage late in 82, he'd asked me if I'd be...
72.
Thank you very much. I get my decades mixed up. Even my centuries I'll get mixed up. So listen to me carefully. And so sometime late at 72, he approached me to ask if I might be interested. And I was interested. I was intrigued by the intellectual type of challenge, political challenge. I underestimated, of course, but it would face. And I was kind of ready to think about what I want to do in the next stage of my life. And so I said I would be interested. And that sort of started it. The senior partner of Arthur Young, wonderful man, Ralph Kent, I think had been designated as the first president of the foundation, Financial Accounting Foundation. And John Bingham said, well, go over and see him. And I think he sort of said, don't back off on this job. I had no actually intention of backing off on it at all. And so when Ralph asked if I'd be interested, and I said yes, and if you're asking me, I say yes, I'll do it. And so it didn't take much explanation or at all about it. I was ready to do it. So
tell me about what you were faced with when you came in and sat down with the other six folks, and you've got a blank slate and a chance to start over. What were the priorities? How did you split up the work?
We had obviously a list of things that the APB hadn't finished or suggested we deal with. So in some time in, I think probably February, maybe even before people had officially gone on the payroll of whatever this organization was going to be, and we used a space, an office space had been found, but it was being renovated, and we used a conference room in a neighboring building, and we had, I think, every board member to be there around that table.
Are you in D.C. at this point?
No,
New York?
It had been decided at the get-go by the foundation organizers that they would be in the general New York area. They decided they didn't want to be too close to Washington. They didn't want to be captured. Mm-hmm. And then they also decided to make it easier to attract people from maybe different parts of the country, maybe the suburban area would be better than in the city itself. So it was decided to headquarter in Stamford, Connecticut. And all these things had been done very rapidly in 72, and were sort of in place by the time I even considered it. And that also had some appeal to me. I was at that time living out here, and it was decided to be in Stanford. We met in this conference room, and we talked about what we should put on our initial agenda, and we had seven board members, so we said, well, let's figure out what sort of seven subjects they were, and we'll ask a board member to sort of head up the project, and when we hire staff, we'll get some help for the board members to sort of shepherd these projects. So we hadn't really decided on sort of how we were going to kind of operate. And so we had a long list of issues that had been passed on to us. And sort of out of all this, we assigned a project to each of the board members. Now, we were sort of a mixed bag of people. Marshall Armstrong was the chair, and he had spent at least a tour on the APB. Not that the technical subjects were his expertise, but he had done all the right things, sort of climbing the ladder in the American Institute hierarchy, and had been the senior partner of a medium-sized firm, Georges Olive and Indianapolis. And having appointed the wheat study and the true blood study, and he was designated as the chair. Great appeal, maybe to the American Institute. Mm-hmm. The vice chairman also was selected for great appeal to the American Institute, and a wonderful, fine gentleman, John Queenan. And John had been, he was then the retired senior partner of Haskins and Sells, which is, I guess, now Deloitte, through various mergers. And he had been on the Committee on Accounting Procedures. He had been on the Accounting Principles Board. And a wonderful gentleman. But again, to have a great appeal to the American Institute of CPAs. Bob Sprouse, who I mentioned earlier, outstanding individual. At that time, he was a professor at Stanford. He had taught for a while at Harvard Business School. Marvelous personal story, really, about him. And had been a co-author on one of those research studies that the APB rejected.
Right.
And Walter Schutz, I was the youngest member. Walter was slightly older than I was. Walter had come from Pete Marwick Mitchell. He had actually worked with the APB member from Pete Marwick Mitchell. So he had some kind of insights into at least the workings of the old regime. It was myself, Arthur Litke, L-I-T-K-E, who was out of Washington. He had a career in the federal government. He might have been one with, like, the Federal Power Commission, and was sort of in more of the rate-regulated kind of industry. He had been active in sort of professional activities, accounting professional activities as well. And then Robert Mays. Bob either was in the throes of retiring from what is now Exxon, or had been retired a short time. He had been, he had moved around with Exxon. He'd been in Venezuela. I think his last position with Exxon was as controller. A very smart, curmudgeonly guy. So he joined. And so none of us were current technical kind of gurus. Maybe Walter Schutz was the closest. Bob Sprouse was probably the only one in the group that had seriously thought about foundations and objectives of reporting. And so we tried to sort out what needed to be done. And we gave lease accounting, which had been... That's our neighborly fox who was trotting across, looking a little scrawny right now. But we're pausing for a almost looks like a hyena. Wow, at the tail is just that's not healthy. Maybe I've got my animals wrong, but. So back to there we were sitting around the table trying to decide what to deal with, and Bob Sprouse said, "Well, someday we're going to have to get around to concepts and principles, but what we really should do is make sure we take a couple of projects which could put some discipline into the balance sheet, into the assets and liabilities of financial statements." I'll come back to this, but there were schools of thought about what you were trying to measure in financial statements. And all of us knew that there were all kinds of things on the asset side of the balance sheet, cost deferrals of different kinds. And then on the right side of the balance sheet, there were things that maybe really weren't liabilities, but were there for future, quote, contingencies. And so various devices in the balance sheets to sometimes smooth out income. And so we said, well, let's take two projects, both of which were recommended to us. One was research and development costs, and the other was, quote, contingencies. And let's put that on the agenda. Let's struggle with those issues, and maybe that'll help us kind of sort things out.
Get some early wins, that kind of thing.
Sorry?
Get some early wins, some things you can sort of...
Deal with an immediate kind of problem, but try to attack it with kind of a conceptual notion in mind. How are we going to decide going forward when something's admittable as an asset? How are we going to decide when it's time to recognize you have a liability? When is it time to recognize the liability doesn't exist anymore? So we thought both those projects would be helpful, and they really were. They were very, very helpful in forcing us to struggle with what concepts do we, as a board, have in mind. We knew we were going to be together for quite a few years, and we were full-time, we needed to start to think about what kind of discipline is going to be there for our own decision-making. And so... those two projects were very, very helpful. Bob Sprowse said, well, we can't just limit it to research and development. Let's call it research and development and similar costs. Well, after years of struggling with what similar costs were, we erased that from the project. It always was the thought to try to think big, but when you came down to trying to resolve the issue, you were often better off being narrow. Mm-hmm. And we discovered that, well, whatever these similar costs were, they didn't seem to be very similar with research and development.
Well, speaking of thinking big, yeah, I mean, you didn't wait too long to sort of put the conceptual framework idea up there and start working on it.
Yeah, we didn't, because initially... We avoided it. We got sidetracked a little bit. People thought we got sidetracked a little bit. I urged that we take something on called qualitative standards for financial reporting, which really was focusing on behavior, attitude of auditors and financial officers. And as much as I thought that was an essential ingredient into financial reporting, as accounting standard setters, it didn't quite fit. And that program sort of morphed into the conceptual framework project.
Okay.
And we also had to start hiring staff. And but we had these seven projects that we were moving ahead with, and then we started to have some board member changes. John Queenan had come on board with a rather short horizon about how long he would stay. He was given the project of materiality, which eventually sort of found its way into the conceptual framework. But and he was replaced by Oscar Galeen. Oscar was a retired partner of Haskins & Sells, a man with an extraordinary, kind, jovial personality, which was very helpful in explaining things and trying to persuade people. And he replaced John Queenan. He had been on the True Bloody study group. He had been on the Accounting Principles Board, and he was an absolute great addition for trying to help organize the conceptual framework projects. Bob Sprowse, because of his background, was an incredible positive asset in moving that project along.
Was there one person spearheading the project?
Well, the one who eventually... I don't recall exactly when Reed K. Story joined the FASB.
Staff member.
Staff member. Senior position. Not the research director, but he had the history of the past attempts. He had been the prime author of an accounting APB statement, I think it was number 4, which wasn't a standard, but it had to do with kind of the objectives and the elements of financial statements. Very, very good piece. And so he brought that kind of background to the FASB and was there throughout the project. And exceptionally skilled writer, and he's recorded the kind of the history of all the endeavors to develop a conceptual framework.
Where has he recorded it?
This particular document.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll get that site before I leave.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very, very good. It kind of goes back into the early endeavors, and also it deals with the shortcomings of what we so far had accomplished.
What was in those early years, early to mid 70s? What were some of the biggest accomplishments? I mean, this is 1988. Well, the conceptual framework took a long time in between.
Yeah, it did.
What were some of the high points?
I guess
points?
It was maybe the last document was about late 85, something like that, and. There, it was an immense kind of struggle, but to even get as far as we did, but in the framework, but we were also dealing with a lot of other kind of issues, and a lot of more, in a sense, conceptual, because people had different attitudes about what the financial statements were trying to do. Were they a statement of just kind of stewardship of management? Or were they trying to be useful to users of financial statements? Was the role of the accountant and the company and the auditor to kind of normalize income? Was it supposed to be sort of an indicator of earning power? Or was it to be sort of a measure of the change in your assets for the year? I mean, there were all kinds of differing attitudes about what financial reporting was to do. And so those were kind of recurring themes that we would kind of hear as we tried to deal with various technical issues. But if you were trying to direct me towards...
Yeah, I want to get a sense of some of the landmarks in the period before you became chairman. What were some of the things that stood out in that period?
See, I was designated to become chairman. I was designated in 77 to assume chairmanship January 1st of 78. In that period of time, we were, oil and gas was kind of a big issue right at the time that I was assuming the chairmanship. Kind of going back chronologically, certainly those two initial statements on research and development and contingencies were kind of very important and significant, and trying to help kind of put boundaries on what people call accrual accounting, trying to put some bookends on what was kind of acceptable. And so... all of these early ones on leases, foreign currency translation, all of them were kind of significant and sometimes very controversial. Case of foreign currency, which was number 8, it got totally redone as statement number 52 years later. 52 was an interesting one, but that was after my chairmanship. So, it all, and there was trouble in New York City in the 70s, and it put on our agenda restructured debt, restructuring of debt. And this one just sort of sprung out of the threat of New York City defaults and the bank, the fact that the banks held the municipal bonds.
Right.
And the kind of age-old question, what circumstances require you to value or adjust the carrying amount of a loan or a bond or such that you mm-hmm. might hold? And so here all of a sudden was this threat of New York City bankruptcy, and we had every CEO of the major banks come to a public hearing and attracted an immense amount of attention and back and forth kind of pressure on this one. And so that was probably the first that attracted a very vocal group of testifiers at mm-hmm. a public hearing. And the final solution to it sort of reinforced a saying at the time that a rolling loan gathers no loss. The answer, there was a theoretical basis for it, was that just changing the terms or such didn't require any kind of revaluation of those loans. Two of us dissented to the document, thinking that it was deferring some losses that maybe should be recognized. And one instance that really had been recognized previously, but this document gave a way to get around it. And secondly, we felt that the two of us felt that the fact that you had a different debtor on these loans, they became a state agency bond. They were no longer a New York City bond. But the fact that you had a different debtor was reason to revalue the loan. Mm-hmm. Now, that was sort of theoretical. It didn't necessarily mean there'd be a loss or such. But the fact that those events were no longer requiring a revaluation disturbed two of us, and we dissented.
Well, that's essentially the mark-to-market discussion that we're having
it
now.
It does. It's when do you, how do you account for loans? When do you recognize an impairment in the value? How do you measure an impairment in the value?
Were there discussions, I mean, the outright political implications of this are profound in that if you, you know, mark the value down, you could create all kinds of catastrophes.
So
did that enter
so
into
some
the
people
discussion?
Say.
Yeah, was
well,
that part of the discussion?
Oh, I'm sure it was. that it depends how you look at it. I mean, there are all kinds of rationales for deciding when you should recognize a decrease in the value, and second, what is that value? And oh, by the way, if you think it's all to make it recover, why recognize anything? And it's a persistent argument. I think it's still going on yeah. today. If you speak to any of the currently involved people, it's...
Right.
It's an issue that's still alive and bubbling. Yeah. So, as are many of the things we dealt with, a few we went back and looked at again, like foreign currency translation. But the agenda and the framework arguments that we had looked at years back are still alive and,
yeah.
and well.
So why did you have a sense of why you came up as being the logical chairman
by
78?
By default. Yeah. It was very kind of difficult times. It was John Moss of the House of Representatives, then Lee Metcalf of the Senate. Sometime, I think it was in 76, the staff of Metcalf put out some huge book called The Accounting Establishment, which really was devastating in a way of its kind of analysis and criticism of the accounting profession. And then we were dealing with the oil and gas issue. Marshall Armstrong was still chair when we put out Statement 19 on oil and gas accounting. And this was incredibly political. But we had just put that out. So I'm not sure anyone would kind of wanted the job from outside. And I guess from looking around inside, I think Walter Schutz had already resigned. He had resigned in 1976. I never forget the little headline in our internal document status report. It said, Kirk reappointed, Schutz resigns. And
cause and effect.
Of course, was the joke. And But Walter decided to resign, and then they were trying to find some counter news to report, and so they gave me a 5-year appointment beginning in 77. So Moss and Metcalf were very much on the horizon, and we were in the midst of the oil and gas issue. Now take me back to your question.
I just want to talk a little bit about why you took the position. And you sort of set the stage for the fact that there were some good reasons why people wouldn't want to take the position.
Right. To me it was a logical step to take. I enjoyed what I was doing, and chance to be chairman was appealing, and there didn't seem, I recognized there wasn't any other. I have no idea whether there were expectations on other people's part at the time, but I think they were, my fellow board members were certainly supportive.
Was there an agenda going forward, or were you at this time really occupied with dealing with the fallout that you've described?
I'd spent a tremendous amount of time in 1977 introducing myself to Washington, D.C. I mean, the Metcalf staff, Moss staff, but it was the Metcalf staff that was more active. I'm not sure how long John Moss stayed in Congress and involved. I really spent a good deal of time. And also because the oil and gas issue was so controversial, there were hearings and all kinds of acts of sort of behind the doors. I mean, I had to testify before the Department of Energy, before the SEC. Mm-hmm. All of this was going on at that time. And so it very controversial. And there was also a structure review of the FASB in 77. And it made a number of recommendations, one of which I welcomed. It was changing the voting requirements. We started out with a supermajority requirement. And in those early years, that bothered me.
Two to five?
Five out of seven was needed.
Okay.
And it was, the Wheat Committee said, because the APB was two out of three, two-thirds requirement, mm-hmm. and maybe for general acceptance, supermajority would make sense. And the APB had allowed things called qualified assents. And if you kind of look back at their statements, they would, maybe they got two-thirds only by having a handful of qualified assents to the document. And we'd study, and our initial procedure said, look, no more qualified assents.
So you started with the supermajority.
Started with the 5-2 majority. And we'd study, it actually said, don't publish the dissents, you know, have in the file somewhere. That never got off the ground. We started right away. In fact, dissents would be and should be published right with the statement. But I witnessed a case or two where the chairman, Marshall Armstrong, sort of had it, or just sort of cast his ballot in a way to somehow get 5. And not when he wasn't wholeheartedly supportive of, mm-hmm. of the particular position, but he couldn't join the two. And it just made no sense to me to put somebody, in particular the chairman, in that kind of position. And so I welcomed when the structure report came out and advocated, I'm not sure the sequence, but they knew we were going to get hung up on oil and gas. We were already hung up on another project. So...
Was this the FAF, the Financial Account?
Founding Foundation, yes.
That did the structure report.
Did the structure report. Mm-hmm. Russell, okay. Russell Palmer was the chair at the time. Man named Bob Sack did a lot of the work for him. Bob Sack at one time worked for the SEC, okay. maybe still associated with the University of Virginia. I don't know. Maybe long retired.
So you were, this wasn't a bad thing because you were stuck with oil and gas. And
we knew we were looked like we were going to be 4-3 on oil and gas, and we looked like we were 4-3 on another. It was kind of welcomed as well.
You said there were two things, one of which you didn't mind. What was the other one?
Out of the structure?
Out of the restructuring.
One which I thought made good sense was open our meetings. We had started... In spite of the wheat study sort of urged openness, we started with the APB approach that only an exposure draft. I mean, you don't, that's it. You wait to get your exposure draft out. You don't want people knocking on your door and all the pressure on you and this sort of thing. And so we started out with... closed meetings for decision making, and but we had public hearings and this sort of thing. So, and there was always this argument: well, you'll be restrained if you know the public's there, or you'll become theatrical or something of the sort, the usual kind of arguments. But even the Moss or Metcalf ones, I think by that stage, say, look, we operate in the sunshine, you should too. And believe it or not, there wasn't unanimity among the board members about the sunshine part. Mm-hmm. I think it was more of a feeling that it would either inhibit or result in showboating or something in a way. So I think that the major points were majority voting, openness. There were, I'm sure, a number of other things, but I think those were kind of...
It's easy to see what the majority... It's easy to see how the majority voting would help. How did the openness, the sunshine approach help?
I think it added to these confidence in the structure, in a way. And it didn't as far as I, from my particular input, I don't think it changed anything. I don't think there was a downside to it.
Okay.
I welcomed the thought of it. And so, I mean, depending on the subjects, we'd have an audience. Some of the firms or some of the publications tended to have somebody there kind of all the time for board meetings. And so those were kind of the issues and these very aggressive actions on the part of those opposed to our oil and gas endeavors.
What was the nut of the oil and gas controversy?
It was, in simplistic terms, a debate between what's called the successful efforts method of accounting and the full cost method of accounting. Successful efforts tended would sort of look at each well as a separate kind of venture. And if you found reserves, fine, it was could become an asset. If you didn't, it was a dry hole and be an expense.
Okay.
Full cost approach sort of said, well, we always have losers and we got some winners, and the dry holes are really part of our exploration endeavor, search for oil, and they shouldn't be written off as long as we're continuing to sort of explore in a general area.
Gotcha.
Now, there was no definition on area. Some companies looked upon the United States as an area, or North America as an area. And others tended to put little smaller boundaries kind of on it. And there were a couple of accounting firms that were, it was really divided. In some ways, it was like the bigger companies versus the smaller companies.
Hmm.
And the arguments about, oh, you don't want to harm the smaller companies by requiring them to use successful efforts accounting. And it became very, very political. And the leader of the opposition to it was the chairman of International Paper Company.
Hmm.
He was General Electric educated, J. Stanford Smith. And they had acquired a smaller exploration company. And they just became, they weren't alone, but they were, he was a motivating force in raising objections to what the board seemed to be headed towards. And so it was a very, very political. I mean, I've met more congressmen and senators in that process of trying to explain what the board was up to. And
did they put pressure on you directly, other than just talking?
On this issue, I don't recall any personal appeals other than countering whatever I would say at, you know, public hearings
right.
and such.
Right.
But no other kind of pressure. And I don't recall among our trustees of the foundation who occasionally would step over the boundary. On this issue...
The boundary being not being involved in,
right,
in the standards.
Right, right. The president of the foundation at the time was Alva Way of General Electric Company. And General Electric, beginning with Reginald Jones, had been a supporter of the FASB. And I'll come back to Reginald Jones and the Business Roundtable, which was another source of controversy. Alva Way testified on what we were trying to do in some of the hearings, SEC hearings, and I remember. And so I don't recall that there was any kind of opposition to what we were doing or proposing to do from the trustees, nor do I recall any personal arm twisting or phone calls, sort of, on this particular issue. It was all in sort of public forums.
Okay.
What went on behind the scenes on trying to influence those who in Washington were going to have an opinion, I don't know. Ultimately, the SEC was required by legislation to, from de novo, to relook at the issue.
Okay.
That got into some midnight rider legislation.
Which took it off your table.
But we got our statement out at the end of 1979. We knew we had to get it out. We weren't quite sure what was going to happen politically, but we wanted to at least be on the record as to what we thought. It got out 4-3, but it did get out. And,
well, you had mentioned the business roundtable, and the next thing on my agenda was corporate pushback against some of the standard-setting initiatives.
Early on, when we were, I mentioned that Roger Smith was on the wheat study.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, when the FASB was formed, Tom Murphy, I believe, started an accounting principles committee of the business roundtable. And of course, he was the sort of first chairman of that. I remember on that committee were Cliff Garvin of what is now Exxon, Reg Jones of General Electric. I remember them because they were sort of, those two were kind of sympathetic voices to what the FASB was trying to do. Garvin may have been more in the Roger Smith inherited that position from Tom Murphy. But Tom Murphy was gentlemanly. But he had a very strong view about historical cost and stewardship and a very definite inbred kind of philosophy. And anything that smacked of changing, matching, and historical cost was anathema to him in the General Motors lexicon.
Changing away from historical cost.
Yes, yes. Any little ribble that thought made it look like you were going to do that. And the board was emphasizing assets and liabilities and not matching of revenue and expenses. I mean, what's going on? But he was always gentlemanly about it. Somebody compiled the correspondence among him, myself, Oscar Galeen, and kind of went on for years. He'd write these letters and we'd write back. But he had a very definite viewpoint. Roger Smith came on the scene to chair that committee. And he said, you know, when we did this wheat study, he said, I ordered chicken salad. And you know what I got? Chicken shit. That's what I got from this FASB. And that was him. I mean, that was that was Roger Smith in a nutshell.
Yeah.
He would turn up the heat. They were always, General Motors was absolutely frightened about what might come out of pension accounting and health care cost accounting. I think they knew they had maybe a ticking time bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And
huge legacy costs.
Huge. But they had an immense rationale for these costs. I mean, these costs didn't attach to people. They were just kind of costs out there that you needed to just spread out over an unmeasurable horizon of time and such.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got a fair amount of heat from that round table, but particularly when Roger Smith became the chair. I became so exasperated in trying to deal with him and kind of the views that I said to the trustees one time, I said, you know, you ought to go meet with these guys and listen to their kind of malarkey. And that was a big mistake. It was a big mistake. It was sort of later in my time. And the then chairman of our foundation was a former, I think, institute president, not a hired person, but, you know, the kind of professional representative. And he was kind of thought of himself as a great accommodator. And instead of sort of seeing through all the smoke from Roger Smith and a group, I mean, all of a sudden became concerned that, you know, boy, something's really got to be wrong here at the FASB and this sort of thing. And that really sort of gets me to the late years of my tenure. But so that business roundtable would flare up at times. And John Reed also, who was came on that committee also of Citicorp, he also was a thorn in our side, and he had advocated times that we should just go out of business, and they knew better how to deal with maybe the government agency than with us.
Now let's touch on that. I want to. The one thing we haven't talked about is your relationship with the SEC. And Sandy Burton's doing a lot of things in this period.
Yes, of course.
And people are saying, well, why don't we just give this to the SEC as well?
Right.
Tell me a little bit about the backstory on that.
Well, when the FASB was organized, Ray Garrett was chair. Sandy was chief accountant. I had a brief encounter with Marsha Armstrong and I. It had to be before this all got organized. I don't know, it was late 72 or when. But he asked me to go down to the SEC with him. And we met with Bill Casey. Maybe it was sort of transition time. And I think Brad Cook was chair for sort of a short period there. And I remember after we met with Bill Casey, Marsha and I both looked at each other and they said, did you understand what he was saying? neither of us did. I mean, as you know, from history, he was famous for almost people thought he had put marbles in his mouth just so people wouldn't quite understand what he was saying. And but by the time we were organized, Sandy was the chief accountant. Ray Garrett was the chairman, and I think Al Summer maybe was also on the commission about that time. But there was an issue with what the relationship between the board and the SEC would be, and Sandy believed that we should pre-clear everything with him and his office. And we said, no, we can't do that. I mean, we're set up to be independent. If it looks like we're subordinate to or starting out definitionally being first accountable to the SEC, we would never make it. We'd never have a chance. Can't be done. And then he sort of said, well, maybe you can take care of accounting. We'll take care of disclosure. And so I said, well, they're really kind of inseparable. So much of financial reporting, financial statements, it's definitionally, it involves a lot of disclosures. We just don't think that's workable. I mean, if you think there's something in addition to what we might come up with, that's obviously, you know, within your powers. And you have the reserve power. I mean, if you don't like what we've done, you can upset it or reject it or whatever you might do. we really needed to operate kind of independently. And we had an early round table with Ray Garrett, Sandy, and there were some others. Maybe Al Sommer was there. I may have my years confused. Where this subject came up. And Ray Garrett saw what our kind of dilemma was, and we kind of came away from that with kind of an understanding. I think we used the phrase mutual non-surprise. We would do what we could to alert the SEC in a way, because again, we didn't have open meetings until we had exposure ground. But we'll find a way, and we hope you will reciprocate, and so we'll kind of go on this informal basis of mutual non-surprise. And the SEC did, I think it was a accounting series release number 150, something like that, did sort of acknowledge that we were now, the FASB was now the sort of standard setting body.
Right.
That it would look to.
So that was the result of those discussions?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And my time sequences may be not quite right, but kind of working out the accounting series release and understanding of how we might operate.
So how did that accord work?
It worked fine. Maybe until oil and gas, but it seemed to work out all right. Sandy had, you know, strong views on a number of issues and such, which of course we listened to and such. But as far as kind of Ray Garrett kind of, I think, saved the day on that kind of relationship, mm-hmm. in a way. So that was the way it sort of started. And Sandy was there, I think, until about 70, 76, something like that. And we heard a fair amount from him, and obviously even subsequently, we started to deal with an issue on inflation. And Sandy had some sort of strong views on that. And he was never reluctant to, you know, criticize what the board was doing. So I think that worked out. And he was followed by, I think, Clarence Sampson. Clarence was the chief accountant really through the rest of the time period I was there. And Clarence, I think it may be a Sandy, had always been a member of the advisory council to the board. And Clarence was always very open with us, and to the extent that we could be, we were open, or at least our rules said we could, with Clarence. So I'm not aware of any kind of conflicts or run-ins. So I think it was
okay.
A relationship of mutual respect and such.
One more topic for this FASB period is the emergence or the creation of the Emerging Issues Task Force. Tell me about where that came from.
I'd have to think back as to where the trigger was, or you have an indication what year that?
Sometime in the early 80s, I believe.
Oh, okay. I don't know where the issue may have come from, but there was this kind of, there was this great issue of whether we were dealing with enough issues. And
you probably felt like you were.
Well, we tried to think that we were dealing with enough of the issues, and then we said, my God, can't you auditors kind of resolve some of these issues on your own? And the practical matter was concluded that they really couldn't without some kind of umbrella from the FASB. And I don't know if there was a triggering event. I don't recall. I really have to search.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to get a sense of what the concerns were during that period and whether you felt like the creation of that body addressed the concerns.
It was thought to address the concerns. It gave kind of a forum. We kind of worked out the process for how it would communicate what it had dealt with. Then the authority of the group, that sort of got debated over a period of time, and I think got resolved after I had gone.
Anything else we should talk about during the FASB years that we've missed?
Well, we did develop a number of statements under this conceptual framework umbrella. Certainly, even the objectives statement ran into some opposition to kind of decision usefulness, that you should really focus on stewardship. Statement number two, dealing with what makes accounting information useful, qualitative characteristics of financial information, was a brilliantly written a piece in large part by David Solomons, a first-class piece of work, very helpful in a way. The third dealt with elements. How do you define what are the characteristics of assets and liabilities? There were really four of substance. The rest kind of involved reshuffling because of nonprofits and such. The one on recognition and measurement. To some people, this was going to be all and end all. It would settle forever, whether it's historical cost or current value. Individuals have strong views on one way or the other. The statement, always thought, went about as far as it could, but that was not very satisfactory to many people. It more or less said, if there's some measurement basis that is more relevant and reliable is a catchy word, but representationally faithful about what you're trying to represent, then it should be used rather than historical cost. There was no way that we could get the board members, including myself, to just accept a value measure rather than historical cost. I mean, as an overall measurement tool. Everyone wanted to focus on, well, what does that mean for this situation? What does it mean for this situation? How are you going to value that? How are you going to value this? And so everyone on the board, or those who were skeptical about whether you could value everything in a balance sheet, would turn around and say, well, how do you deal with this? How do you deal with that? And we were trying to have unanimity on these right. concept statements. And we had three very recalcitrant people on how far they might go on saying anything about valuation.
Was there a common denominator, a position, something that explained where they were coming from?
Well, there was. We ended up with the only dissent in that statement, dissent by John March, which was sort of a full blast endorsement of historical cost and matching as a solution. And the statement, even as far as it went, was suggestive that that wasn't what the board was endorsing. But the struggle goes on. I mean, whether you're talking on the international scene or whatever it is, the same struggle is going on now.
Right.
So that, in a nutshell, sort of takes care of the conceptual issues.
Had a decision to step down from the FASB, had you just sort of felt like it had run its course?
No, I had run out of time. When I was initially appointed, I had less than a five-year term. They staggered the initial terms. And it was a fairly long one, but it wasn't 5 years. And they said that it didn't count. They had a 2 5-year term limit.
Gotcha.
And they originally said that these shortened terms didn't count. So it technically made me eligible for 2 5-year terms. We talked about in 86, I was reappointed beginning in 77, I think, for a 5-year term. And so in the second term, I had to really sort of debate whether I wanted to stay or go. And they, it was a troubled time. Everything was a troubled time. And I don't think they had any other logical candidates or something at that time. And so, I mean, I debated whether it made sense to stay or not stay. But I chose to stay. So my time had just run out, my term. And they subsequently changed it. Nobody could serve more than 10 years, I think, is the limit.
So you did some teaching and things like that.
Right. And if you'd seen as the board, you know, the voting requirements and the size of the board, I mean, those issues seem to recycle all the time, too.
Right.
But so I stepped away because my time was up. And actually it was Sandy Burton who asked if I'd like to join the faculty. He was dean at the School of Business. A little ironic, but... people said, "You're going to go to work for Sandy?" I said, "No, I mean, you know, a college professor doesn't work for anybody other than themselves." So I joined the faculty. They were very accommodating to me, more so than I really deserved. I took on some other things, and I had never done any teaching. I don't have a PhD, and I learned an awful lot teaching. I had mixed success as a teacher, and but they were very good, and so I had a nice relationship at Columbia.
How did you get the opportunity to work on this kind of landmark study for the Public Oversight Board?
I'm not sure. I necessarily call it landmark. Maybe it was referred that way somewhere, but in 19. Walter Schutz was chief accountant at the SEC, and he had given a couple of speeches accusing the auditors of being cheerleaders or advocates for their clients rather than sort of independent, objective viewers. A very valid observation on his part. You know, I knew enough that can go on. I mean, it's the temptation of a partner on some assignments to want to get the answer that the client wants and such. And I think he, Walter, or maybe, you know, I think it was the profession, sort of said, look, he's harping on us for this kind of stuff. Public Oversight Board, can you do something and look into this kind of issue? So that's kind of what triggered the POB to say, let's do some kind of look at the independence of the auditor and such. And how they settled on me, I have no idea. I think they had settled on George Anderson, who had been a small practitioner from Montana, who had been in the hierarchy of the American Institute of CPAs. And I think we sort of mutually, somehow with Al Summer, settled on Ralph Saul. I had known Ralph somewhat. He had been a trustee of the Fidelity Group of Funds. And I admired his independence. and So, so we end up with three of us being asked by the POB to look into the issues on auditor independence, and we maybe clear up, you know, up front that, you know, we can't try to just rehash these sort of five cases that the SEC had and been somehow resolved in some way. And we were assured that no, it should be sort of broad based.
Systems, look at the system, I guess. System.
Yeah, and try to see if there's anything that systemically that maybe could be done or might be done. And so in 95, we started this study or process, and I think we maybe started in 94, but I think 95 we issued the report on enhancing the professionalism of the independent auditor. And it was, I remember going down to explain it to Arthur Levitt, who was chair, and Walter Schutz. And we were sitting at a table, and I sort of described the report, what we did, what we were concluding. And I could almost see the steam come out of Walter's ears, who's been upset ever since, I think, because it didn't kind of redo or rehash or the five cases or such, or it didn't conclude, yeah, the auditing profession is nothing but cheerleaders, you know, for their...
What did it conclude?
It really focused on audit committees and the fact that we had to find a way to get them more involved in the judgments about financial reporting. And the auditor had to build that relationship, and it had to assume responsibility to make judgments about the financial reporting, not just about its compliance with the rules, but really the quality of the reporting. Mm-hmm. Was it bordering on being too aggressive, bordering on being too conservative? And they really had to be forthright in those communications. Now, this frightened some of the auditors who said, somehow we're supposed to express like a preference for an accounting method. And so it took a while, but the auditing profession kind of built it into their requirements of what an auditor needs to report to audit committees. And the report was a good benefit to a blue ribbon committee that sort of followed on dealing with audit committee responsibilities, which was sort of put to Arthur Levitt had pushed the stock exchange and NASDAQ to kind of find a way to build into maybe their listing requirements or such. The SEC, didn't think it had a way to dictate audit committee behavior, but hit upon the fact that maybe in the listing requirements of the exchanges that they could achieve what they wanted to achieve, which I think they did do. So it also had a number of other kind of issues in it, but that was kind of the main focus of getting the auditor to feel a special responsibility of the audit committees. Then the Blue Ribbon Committee came along and found a mechanism to kind of build it into listing requirements and such.
It's interesting. You had a sort of a 10-year period, a little less than 10 years, away from the profession or direct involvement. That in retrospect was a pretty important period. Did you see the profession change significantly from the 80s to the 90s? As far as things like professional involvement in academics, writing, and of course the related services that were coming in?
Well, I was an observer, but not directly involved. A lot of people said once the even the FASB came into play, the the leadership of the accounting firms sort of lost their role in standard setting accounting decisions. And therefore, their leadership didn't need to be so knowledgeable. And there clearly were maybe a trend towards those who were more client-oriented and business-getting-oriented. It also was a time when the other services of the firms became kind of emphasized. So there clearly were those changes taking place. What sort of the time frames were, but certainly it was happening in that period of time. And by the time I joined the POB, it was, you know, very, very obvious what the situation, what the environment
was. And was the POB addressing this directly?
Well, the POB got organized the same time as we at the FASB were going through structural changes, oil and gas, Moss and Metcalf. Out of the various hearings, the Institute reorganized itself and tried to improve its peer review process, its investigative process, and formed what was called the SEC Practice Section, brought together all those auditors who audited SEC registrants and public companies, and established kind of a framework for doing peer reviews, inquiry into alleged audit failures. And the POB was built into that kind of original structure. Right. I think obviously all this was the AICPA's response to the Metcalf tome, the accounting establishment.
Right.
And
But things had changed by the time you came on the POB. Was it 94?
95.
95. And you know, it's less the, well, maybe it's moved a level up.
When I went on board, I was the first new member in 10 years. The group I joined had been, including the man I replaced, Bob Mounts, they had been together as the five-member board for 10 years. And that really is sort of dramatic. There were no term limits at all. I was replacing a man who wore many hats. He was a CPA, he was a recognized professor, he was a retired Ernst & Young partner. He was sort of the public voice in sort of describing what the POB activities were and what peer review was all about. The chairman, who was the second chairman, was Al Sommer, a man for whom I had immense respect. Absolute immense respect. A thoughtful, wonderful person. And he was chair a long time. And so here, this group was in place. Al Sommer, Mel Laird, Bob Froelke, Bob Mounts, who was stepping down, and Paul McCracken, recognized economist, professor at the University of Michigan. That was the group I was joining. And the board had done a number of things in those years that their activities kind of accelerated later, and often with kind of push and shove pressure from the SEC and push and shove pressure from the American Institute and such. So they had been kind of diligent overseers of the activities of the SEC practice section had a very small but very professional staff. Jerry Sullivan was head of the staff when I joined, and he was until the day the FASB closed up. I'm sorry, the POB closed up. A very competent professional. So the POB had, by the time I came, had in its very earliest day expressed an attitude about other services by auditors. And in fact, I think one of the first things they did, probably in 78, was to tell the SEC practice section that, no, you don't need to put limits on what other services the auditors provide. The SEC practice section was going to limit those practices to those that required accounting and auditing expertise. And the Public Oversight Board said, no, you don't want to do that. You want to sort of keep your eye on what goes on. If they really become aggressive salespeople of unrelated services, then you maybe should stomp on it. But you don't want to initially limit it. So keep your eye on it. And, oh, yes, there's disclosure now required of management service revenue. And that'll be sort of a pressure as well. So their first action was actually to say, oh, you're going to stifle this business opportunity that the firms have and this sort of thing. And they, I think, learned to kind of regret that.
Was that apparent by 1995?
Well, it actually it became apparent in 1986. I don't recall what triggered it, but the POB did had a survey done of attitudes about other services by the auditing firm. And they found there was really divided opinion about it, and that really a lot of people thought it was a bad idea, but others said it was okay. And I think about the same time, the requirement to disclose the revenue from those other services, I think from a lot of pressure from the Institute, got dropped. So the behavior of the firms was troublesome, and the lack of disclosure about the fees was also kind of troublesome. And then in 1993, they did a very expansive report when the Institute asked the POB if they would jump in and help fight for tort reform to sort of find a way to minimize the auditors' responsibilities for or limit their the amount that they could be sued for and such. And the Oversight Board said, well, first, though, we want to undertake a good study of a lot of other activities. And in 93, they issued this special report on the practice section, and a very comprehensive review of the activities of the practice section with a lot of suggestions on what should be done to improve it, modify it. They even considered other forms of regulation. Thought about whether an NASD type organization should be done. So it was very kind of wide ranging, and concluded that no, they should really try to keep it outside of sort of a government endorsed program. And but when I came on in 95, they were regularly following up on the many, many issues that were in it. And so it was a very thoughtful quite a comprehensive report.
What were some of the big initiatives that were that took place in the late 90s? Or things that were commanding most of your time?
At the POE?
Yeah.
It was certainly the ongoing process of overseeing kind of the peer review activities. There was an awful lot of involved in sitting in and listening to their investigations on alleged audit failures, the peer review process. There also was certainly building the this question again about scope of services that was raising its ugly head, and obviously issues about independence of the auditing firms. The I had I was chairman of an audit committee, a Fidelity group of mutual funds, and somewhere in those, I don't know, it was 99, where it was in the time frame, but I became aware that Pricewaterhouse had violated some of the independence rules, prohibitions of employees holding stock in a client company. And Fidelity was the provider for many, many companies, 401k programs and such. And so it was pretty easy for somebody, if they weren't absolutely careful about this, could end up owning or personally a share in a mutual fund company, and my God, it's audited by the firm I'm a member of. And all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, it became aware, I guess it was through an anonymous phone call about, I think, an office in Florida about Coopers and Lybrand partner or person who held stock in a company he audited. And I think there was some follow-up on the phone call. They sure found out that this Cooper's partner, yeah, he did. And it was a very flagrant kind of violation of the rules. And about the same time, maybe Cooper's was combining with Pricewaterhouse. And so the SEC investigation kind of went further. And I don't know all that triggered it, but we ended up spending an awful lot of time, again, on the issue of auditor independence. And I was particularly sensitive to the issue, knowing that there were a tremendous number of technical violations at the Fidelity funds. Mm. And there were hundreds of Fidelity funds, and the question was, well, the auditor wasn't independent, so what happens to our registration? I mean, we had open-end funds. They said, oh my God, what the hell's going to happen? And you can't just say that, take away the registration of these companies. There wasn't any clear-cut process for dealing with this on the SEC's part. And with the help of Dick Phillips, lawyer for the Fidelity Mutual Funds, have been an SEC employee in his career. And I think Ernie Ten Eyck, who at one time had been an SEC employee as well, worked out with the SEC's approval a way of kind of reviewing all of these audits that didn't jeopardize the registration of the funds. Mm-hmm. But I was kind of super sensitive to this issue, whatever, so the registrant, if this happens. And then we started on a process of, at the SEC's request, of trying to do some reviews of the other firms' quality control kinds of system. And this just deteriorated into a struggle, resistance from the auditing firms, changing of the scope of it. It dragged on for years. And it's well documented. My answer to some of this is well documented in the POB's final annual report issued in early 2002. And then, of course, the Enron imploded. And that was in 2001. And there was a peer review going on of Arthur Andersen at the time. And so that set off a flurry of POB activity. And so the last kind of 2 years of the POB, and really started in the late 90s, the issue on kind of scope of service of the firms, the violations of the independence rules, the struggle to define what kind of review might be done of the other firms, or assistance of the firms to that. All it was just a chaotic kind of scene. And
was part of this because of the POB didn't have a great deal of authority.
No, it had absolutely no authority in the sense of it could only try to persuade and suggest. It had no special. I think we got a new charter in
2001.
Yes, sometime in 2001, which tried to say, well, we could do investigations of any kind, but we still didn't have a hammer.
Right.
Up to that time, it was solely kind of persuasion and public reporting. That was the only powers the board had. So when Lynn Turner asked that we do these studies, being the oldest hand on the board, I said, you know, you've got the clout. We don't have the clout. And it took, I think, 2 years of negotiation between the SEC and the firms as to what kind of studies might be done. Then, even after that was sort of hammered out between those parties, trying to get the firms to give us the information, it just was chaotic. So
now, you stepped down before the board officially dissolved itself, is that correct?
I resigned, I think within a day or so, of when Harvey Pitt announced what sort of structure or he was going to, was it in mid-January of 2002? Wow. Yeah, mid-January of 2002. There were, the way it was reported, it just, there always had been there had been a great deal of tension between the POB, Chuck Boucher, really, and Harvey Pitt, who had come in as chairman. And Pitt had had a history of being sort of on the institute side on some of the independence kind of issues. And that didn't help. And the Institute clearly was sort of comforted by his becoming chairman. And I just felt that it just was becoming a matter of who shot John and personality clashes. And I was innocent enough to think that, God, I just want to deal with the professional matters and do what I can to help improve the performance of the profession. And I said, enough's enough, and so I stepped down. The others stayed on to really just to finish up their final report, make a proposal of what kind of structure they thought should be put in place. I was asked to oversee the POV staff's kind of wind-up of some of the issues that were kind of left open, these kind of the quality control systems the firms had surrounding independence issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I started in that activity in sort of March, and it went through most of the year, overseeing that wind-up by the professional staff of the old POB. It adopted another name, Transition Oversight Staff, I think, is what it was. So that's
terrific.
The wild and woolly of the POB times. So.
Is there anything that we haven't covered there that we should?
I'm not sure that we should. There's many things that we haven't.
Any highlights of your career in the accounting standards world that?
Well, the issues don't change a great deal, and as you talk to people who were active in it that followed me, you'll hear the same sort of themes. Even structurally, the changing of the size of the board. Hopefully, they'll never go back to a supermajority vote, but you never know. The controversies about the concepts which should underlie the financial statements. Those issues continue to be thrashed out. Once you solve a problem, you discover that it doesn't stay solved forever. Only occasionally does that happen. So there's an awful lot of recycling. I had even said to myself that, you know, once we re-examine something we've done, I know it's time to go. But all of a sudden, we reconsidered foreign currency translation, and I wasn't ready to go. You never know. The issue of not only how you measure things, but where you report it. When you finally get around to valuing something rather than carrying the historical cost, then the argument goes, well, where do you put this gain? What is it? Is this a gain or a loss? Where do you put it? The tendency is maybe to stick it down in shareholders' equity. Or maybe if you have to put it in the income statement, put it down the very, very bottom and not talk about it. Same arguments, they just kind of keep coming back. And current combined boards, which is an interesting exercise of whether you can have truly international standards and whether there's even a potential enforcement mechanism dealing with it. Because without some form of oversight and enforcement, the notion that you can have just broad principles and standards and that'll take care of everything is just not workable.
Right.
Just isn't destined to succeed. Good luck in their endeavors, but I don't see a way that it can work out. I'm not sure I can see the SEC passing the buck in some way to some other super body or the best intentions of the auditing profession.
Right. And if they do, it'll get revisited down the road somewhere.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, thanks very much.
Ken, glad to be part of it.